Council reorganization meeting Monday, March 22nd, room 106B on House Bill 1060.
Why don't you come up here, Ken, please? Why don't you come up and start the front? The Subcommittee on Government Reorganization will come to order. The bill under consideration today is 1060. The first witness is Fleischner. Is that right?
Yes. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pete Fleischner. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Hospitals.
Do you have an alternative to for the licensing problem?
Yes, sir. We approved of the concept which was first in the bill, which established a board, I believe it was seven people, for the purpose of licensure. And that board was made up of two physicians, I believe, and a hospital administrator, nursing home administrator, a nurse, and I think two others. I can't tell you now, I forgot. But that sort of board makes sense to us. We feel there needs to be some professional knowledge involved in the licensure program. I might add that we work very well with the Board of Health. We have no particular problems as it now stands, both from the standpoint of standard setting and from the standpoint of granting licensure.
But you would suggest that we spell the licensing board out in the statutes as to who would
Yes, I think so. My understanding before the gross bill was printed was that there was to be that the CHP and Comprehensive Health Planning would do the licensing, but I don't see that in the bill.
I see.
I'm not so sure that that's the answer to it all. It seems to me that the separate facilities licensing board
question.
No.
Do you think there ought to be a registered pharmacist on this board?
Board of Health. On which board?
On the Board of Health.
I think, yes, that the pharmacist relates to the matter of public health. I don't find any problem with that at all. Anything else?
Is there a pharmacist in the audience?
I'm afraid there is.
This advisory committee, do you think that's necessary?
Yes, sir, I think it is, particularly in the absence of any professional expertise on the licensing board. In other words, there's no board in this bill right now, as I read. And in the absence of such a board, I think there is a real necessity for an advisory committee.
What would be your opinion of taking, for example, we've got five doctors proposed for this board, if maybe the doctors were designated from specific areas rather than general medicine, or my terminology is going to be way off because I'm not a doctor, but rather than just five doctors being on the board, what if you had one from one neurosurgeon and one, give me some terms, what are some medical terms?
Obstetrician
and so forth.
I was putting words in his mouth. He's the one who's concerned about that, not me.
I understand one of our members is a bachelor.
I think the idea of breaking the board representation as far as physicians is concerned into specialties is less advisable than breaking it up geographically from around the state, whether they're specialists, generalists, or whatever. That would be my opinion.
We have all sorts of suggestions for the health board, and everybody thinks that perhaps their group should be on it. Is there any advantage, say, in rotating a dentist and a pharmacist and a health administrator, hospital administrator, or having a list of people of similar ilk and rotating them on the board, or letting the governor pick among them?
Well, I think there is some advantage. First of all, the larger the board, with some limitations, the more cumbersome it becomes. It would seem to me that there could be representation from the various facilities in the state which are licensed. Perhaps this could rotate. As far as the dentists and the pharmacists rotating, I'd rather not comment on that.
Would you have the courage to comment on the number of physicians that we have on the board?
Yes, I'll be that courageous. I think there are plenty of physicians. I think if you're going to add people to the board, you might do it by diminishing the number of physicians, and rather than make the board larger.
Are there any more questions before Mr. Fleischner is fired? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Kennedy, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association. I'm sure the chairman in particular knows the Oregon Medical Association's support of the human resources concept, supported the concept during the Health Task Force Committee's study of the bill. We also supported the concept of a health affairs division within the human resources concept. Our support was strong because we believe, and we still believe, in grouping all related agencies into a grouping for intercommunication, coordination, whatever it might be. In Gross House Bill 1060, the amendment that it contained, totally destroys the concept of health affairs within that division. appear to be deeply concerned about the net effect of these amendments. Unfortunately, we have not had enough time to really study the impact of those amendments. We do see a tendency to fragment the health-related agencies within the size of the Department of Human Resources. I think the Oregon Journal had a very interesting article or editorial last Friday, which expanded on the size of the Department of Human Resources. And we have a great deal of concern of health-related agencies being lost within this huge department. Hence our support of the concept for a division of health affairs when this whole plan was initiated last summer. We would therefore recommend, and strongly recommend, that the division of health affairs be restored into the bill. You know, this would give better coordination, better communication within the health-related agencies rather than being placed in a huge department such as the Department of Human Resources. I add, this is not separate from the Department of Human Resources, but within the Department of Human Resources. We have great fear, you might say, maybe become a little paranoid in this area, of the changes, administrative changes. We have no concern with Governor McCall. Current administrator for Human Resources, Tom Davis. But we do have concern for what may happen in the future. Get a new governor, get a new administrator, and with the broadness of the ability of the administrator to change by rule and regulation, what various arrangements will be in terms of agencies, that it could very well result in health-related agencies being fragmented among the various other agencies and take a very bold place on the so-called pecking order. As far as the comprehensive health planning arrangement within the growth bill, we feel that it's satisfactory. Association has taken a position in support of comprehensive health planning in the statutory body. We do feel, however, that the size, 25 members, could become quite unwieldy. We all have agreed at times when the bodies get too big, they lose their effectiveness. We feel that perhaps the 25 might possibly become too large to be really an effective body. We would suggest that the Comprehensive Health Planning Committee be allowed to elect its own chairman as opposed to the governor selecting the chairman, similar to what the Board of Health Affairs currently does, and they select their own chairman.
Would you choose that from among the members of the committee? Or?
Yes. I would agree with Mr. Fleischner's earlier comments regarding the Health Facilities Licensing Board. As you know, the previous bill, House Bill 1060, had a Health Facilities Licensing Board in it, in which there were advisory committees to advise the board on the requirements and the technical aspects of various things, such as clinical laboratories. Clinical laboratories is a complicated area. We do not have advisory committees with specific duties in these areas. We tend to lose sight of the important features and important factors which constitute a qualified laboratory. So I would agree with Mr. Blackman's comment that the Board of or Licensing Health Facilities would be an important aspect of that. I think we have lose sight of have a department that would be licensing health facilities without any advisory boards for those particular facilities. You could very well lose sight of the whole purpose of licensing those facilities. So I would agree with Mr. Fleischner. And to summarize, that I strongly urge the committee to restore the health affairs division concept within the bill, to elect the comprehensive health planning chairman from within the ranks of the...
Where is that? What line of the bill is that you've got the chairman appointed by the governor?
It's not specified. It doesn't specify. It'll be on page 24, Mr. Chairman.
It says the director of human resources or his designee shall serve as secretary.
Right. But there's nothing that specifies that the chairman of the committee should be selected from within the frame. we would recommend that it be included.
Okay, Bob, anything else? Lee? Wait a minute.
It's not clear in my mind, Bob, how the engrossed copy differs. I mean, I know how it differs, but where your bone of contention is and where it differs from the original copy, from the original bill. And is there any significant part there that upsets your group?
Well, the concept of the original bill was to make digressions and go back. The objective of the original bill create a division of health care within the human resources concept, a separate statutory division that groups these health-related agencies. Mm-hmm. The engrossed bill removes that division of health care so that everything is in the human resources without the umbrella of a health care division. We would strongly recommend that health care division be restored.
I see. Okay.
Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I think your point is well taken. The previous bill did create a statutory barrier between health affairs agencies that would become part of the human resources department, inconsistent with the rest of House Bill 1059, which did not have those statutory barriers to individuals. The reason for leaving it out was to allow reorganization and organization. Better interaction with individuals. His point is that it is different than it was in the original bill. It was done this way in the gross bill to make it consistent with the other parts of the House Bill 1059 that did not create those statutory walls between these agencies and the others.
What are we going to run into if we have one department set up this way and not any of the rest, like welfare and mental health or whatever?
Well, the concern that spoken to is the ability to deal with children's problems as relates to children across the board as opposed to vertical identification of problems. You deal with mental health care and, you know, health care and something else. That's why the barriers weren't in the other bill.
If we restored this, would it hurt the other bill or this one?
It's our preference to leave it this way, but not a big thing.
1059 is not in here anymore.
Bob, your comments on the makeup of the principal board. As you know, through the interim and now, we have numerous people who feel, and with justification, that they should be included on the main board. Do you have any comments on how we can get them all on there without making the board too big, or?
Well, I to be consistent with my comments regarding comprehensive health, I think the smaller the board, the better. I can see all the other groups reasoning on why they all want to be on the Board of Health Affairs. I think we have to decide on an important factor. That is, the Board of Health establishes rules and regulations relating to the health of the community, the health of the state. Those things affect the health. We've experienced on some boards where there's been one physician and a dozen other people that the burden of information still rests, or technical information often still rests with that one physician. We felt that when you have a good balance of physicians on the body, you have a good rounded, well balanced technical expertise to that body. With regard to Johnson's comments about the different types of physicians, the Board of Health is currently composed of physicians throughout the state. Five physicians plus the state health officer, who under this plan would not be a member of the Board of Health. So actually you would have five physicians and the remainder would be the pharmacist, the I wouldn't have any objections. I'm not sure what the medical association's formal feelings would be on this, Chairman, whether they would be a spot for rotating. I think a good person to put on that board would be there.
All right. What about a local health officer? You mentioned local health as one of the primary concerns. We don't have a sanitarian.
Well, here we go back to the concept we originally talked about last summer. State health officer, or county health officer, local health officer, would be in a position of making rules and regulations under which he would follow. And I have a feeling, this is my feeling from previous committees, that it's not a wise thing to have the person who's going to be carrying out the rules and regulations making.
All right, how do you reconcile that argument with the pharmacists on there and the dentist on there?
Well, the dentist and the pharmacist is not, they are not carrying out the rules and regulations for them. They're assisting and providing the expertise to make the rules and regulations. They're the Board of Health, I think, should be an expert body. This is the body that's making the rules and regulations affecting those aspects that affect the health of the state. These people should be experts. I see no objection to having this consumer element on there. I think it's good to have a consumer element on the whole board. Except for the license board. Since we get it in here, I appreciate that. You caught me on half one, Commissioner.
It's bad, isn't it?
Are there any more questions?
I'm still a little confused.
Well, there's naturopathic physicians, there's osteopaths, there's
we added, Mr. Chairman, we added the chairman of the comprehensive health planning body to the board to provide the continuity between the comprehensive health planning and the Board of Health Affairs. Comprehensive health planning involves long-range state. And in order to tie it in with the Board of Health Affairs, added that man to the Board of Health.
Well, now on page 4, line 18, one member should be the chairman of the Comprehensive Health Planning Authority. This is what we were talking about back on page 24, really, wasn't it?
On 24?
With the governor appointing the chairman of the Health Affairs.
Right, this is the individual we're talking about. Who's going to appoint this man? Should it be a governor or should it be a committee? Our feeling it should be the committee to elect its own chairman.
Well,
you have, you have an advisory board in the statutes.
Do you think that advisory board is desirable or necessary?
I think advisory boards are good. If one is necessary, you call upon others to advise, and you have a built-in body that you can call. Admittedly, this particular board that has been advisory to the Board of Health has not functioned very well.
How do you define physician? I mean, what encompasses that that qualifies one as a physician? What
the state?
Well,
through the Board of Medical Examiners, that's the criteria for qualifying a physician.
Is a neurosurgeon a physician?
That's specialized.
But a chiropractor, for example, would not be.
He's not a physician, he's a chiropractor, but he's not a doctor of medicine.
So he wouldn't fall under this definition of physician.
No.
Okay.
How are osteopaths now?
Osteopaths are licensed by the State Board of Medical Examiners and may become members of the medical association.
Would you make any changes in that advisory board?
The advisory board on which page, Mr. Chair?
On page 5.
Page 5. No, not really. I've always wondered why a professional engineer would be on the advisory board. We wouldn't have no recommendations to make changes.
Can you answer that question, Ken?
probably because an engineer, a representative of the engineer originally wanted to be on the Board of Health. Why they created this separate advisory board to put these people somewhere if they all want to be on the Board of Health.
If we took the registered nurse off there and put her over on the main board.
I think you could increase the size of the Board of Health by 1 to 3.
You wouldn't mind increasing the size of the Board of Health, but you'd hate to give up a position, sorry. And you have a suggestion if we took the nurse off of the advisory board, by whom should she be replaced?
I would.
Maybe the nurse president would like to have both places, I'm not sure. Are there any more questions, Mr. Chairman? Thanks, Byron. Representative Graham, did you intend to testify on this bill?
Yes, sir. Representative Graham. Testifying on HB 1060. The corrective in gross printing thereof. I've had a very short time to try to digest the new bill. The old bill, 1060, as you recall, we were trying to develop within the concept of the new executive department reorganization. And 1060 was developed out of that, you're all aware. At the time that this was developed, it appeared that there would be great opposition to trying to reorganize this within the state, the department of the governor, the executive department. Consequently, we went ahead and developed with the interested parties of the medical profession the concept which was acceptable to them. That is House Bill 1060 in the original form. I see that the new corrected and gross printing is not at all like that. And consequently, I would not be able to assure my support to it, or certainly I can't speak for the association in its support. But it's certainly something which is going to take some more perusal by those parties to see if it is something they can live with as compared to the present situation. Talk about barriers between the health division here. I suggest to you that they're extreme barriers, and each of these areas that we put through at 1059 in welfare and various other ones, mental health, as you know, didn't even come into this. It has all the barriers in the world between mental health and the rest of the organization. It's still there. Probably remains so. The medical school, another area of health, separated completely and totally. Insulated and isolated away from home. So when we speak of barriers, I think we've got to approach it quite relevant. And the barriers that are in the original 1060, I would submit, are similar to the barriers of the rest of the other agencies that are presently under human resources. And this is the way the bill was developed, along those lines. Taking those as boilerplates, they should make the Department of Human Resources similar. So if there are barriers, they're along the same lines as the rest of the ones. 1060 changes a number of things from what I've seen in it. We've talked about various parts of it. I'm simply going to give you my opinion and impression on some of them. The Board of Health. I've heard testimony on expertise and ability to accomplish functions with or without expertise. I would caution you to not remove too many people that are experts when you're trying to accomplish something that is far necessary. Mr. Gennetti testified as to the position a physician takes in a group when expertise is required, and I've been serving on the Comprehensive Health Planning Board committee, and I, being one of two physicians out of 25 persons, I know that is exactly true. That's exactly what they've done. They all turn to one or two of us and say, what do we do next, boys? And good. It's much better to have more experts, more cross-current of expert information than having one person rely on it at 25. There are a variety of things. The only thing that I would like to say today is that I would hope that you will hold this bill for a few more days, at least, perhaps a week, until you have complete information as to the interested parties' relative positions on this bill. Because, politically speaking, if it doesn't have their concurrence, it may not get support. And if it doesn't have support, both being put through the House and then implementation thereafter, it will be a sorry piece of legislation. I have high hopes for it. Like very much to see legislation go through that will coordinate the efforts and put the health facilities in this state on a more efficient functioning basis. And that was the original intent. I think it's going to be accomplished.
Do you see any reason why the original 1060 and the gross 1060 couldn't to some extent be amalgamated and take the good part of the beach?
I think that's absolutely possible, and it's my very dear hope that we can do that.
The bill as it's presently written is called the State Board of Health Affairs. Don't you think it's a good idea to eliminate the doctor's affairs at this time?
I have no emotional hang up on affairs.
What about a sanitarian on the main board?
I think we could put an optician on the main board, a sanitarian.
Optician or ophthalmologist?
Optician. Optometrist, ophthalmologist, optometrist, optician. And we could put a sanitarian at grade 1 and a sanitarian at grade 3 and a sanitarian at grade 4 on there. It depends on how far you want to go with this. I think any group like that that's trying to accomplish something, you can get too large. You need your experts. I would hope that you would restrict the group to a small number that are experts with enough input from those from the lay area that it's not totally overrun with best interests.
On 1060 and gross, we have 11 members of the board and do not have a nurse. There's something like 12,000 nurses state of Oregon compared to relatively small numbers like 1,200 doctors, 2,000 dentists or so forth. Do you have any comment about having a nurse on the board?
Nurses are fine and I certainly appreciate your help as far as I'd like to go.
You'll never be a very forceful editorial writer.
I think if you're going to put a sanitarian on the board, if you put an optometrist on the board, an optician on the board, you certainly ought to put a nurse on the board, perhaps an LPN on the board too, and a few other things.
Well, Doug, you don't want to get this too big. You've got 11 now.
No, I really don't think it's bigger than 11.
And then if we keep it 11, we've got to take something off. The only thing we seem to have in excess of is MDs. Well, would you be willing to sacrifice an MD or two to get other people on?
I would be willing very much to give you the information on the history of the Board of Health, which is very interesting, I think, as to how it's developed through the years, for the past 70 years. And only in the past 4 years has there been anything but MDs on the Board of Health. I think the only way to evaluate whether this is good or better is to evaluate performance.
among us girls, how many could you sacrifice?
Oh, none. Absolutely none. And if anything, I would not serve on it.
It's been commented by you and others that maybe the Health Planning Board is too large. What should we make that?
As I understand it, not according to the bill now, it's 25 members is what you're considering.
It's still 25, yeah, in the new bill.
In the new bill, 25 members.
I appreciate you having had time to study this new bill.
I would, again, be selective about this. It's my feeling in sociograms and things that you're not going to be able to accomplish much more than much with any committee that's larger than 12 members. Get over 12 members, you're reducing the efficiency of your committee and getting things done. And I would say that I would try to restrict it to 12 members. You're going to have half of those lay members. There's no interest in any part of medicine or health delivery required by the federal government. So that means that you're going to have, if you can restrict it to 12, then only five of those could be experts. You certainly could use some experts. And I know your political problems here of calling everybody's vested interest and being on the board and everywhere in government, but I think it's irresponsible that you purpose to look to the effectiveness of that government.
Do you have any questions or Dr. Grant? Would you be willing to serve on a subcommittee along with Dr. Press and Ken Underdahl and Representative Patterson and maybe Dr. Crowthers to work on this thing some more?
Be very happy to. Very happy to.
Thank you very much, Dr. Green. All of you, I think Mr. Patterson has Mr. Johnson has some questions too.
I just had one. Paula, this weekend, as I was trying to read over this, but did you catch that, Coach? I noticed one thing in here that it just raised a question in my mind. It says, the members of the board shall be appointed by the governor. Now this is on page 15, line 28. The members of the board shall be appointed by the governor from a list of 10 names suggested by the Oregon State Nurses Association. And I know that's the only thing in here that has names suggested, and I was just curious about that.
I really don't know historically why it's written in there. I believe it has been a provision in our law from the time that it was written. Thank you. closed session. But, you know, the concept of the healthcare division within the department came to make for the comfortable one, too. Therefore, I think we're still favoring that.
Okay, Bob, thank you very much. Does anybody else have anything to say about this bill?
Jim? I'd like to make one comment, I think perhaps for emphasis, that while it's not argumentative in the testimony, I would like to call attention to subsection 3 of section 1 of the bill, which sets a policy statement, and I think it does relate to some of the concerns of the licensing board area, professional area. I'll read it for those that don't have a bill. Enacting this act is the intention of legislative attendance to provide for more effective coordination of the administrative functions of the board's charge of the responsibility of protecting the public through the licensing, regulating health-related professions practices in the state. And I think this next sentence is extremely important. Further, it is the intention of the legislative assembly to retain responsibility in the professional licensing board, members of which are qualified by education, training, and experience, to make the necessary judgments for decisions on qualifications, standards of practice, licensing, discipline, and other discretionary functions related to professional activities. The intent of this particular section here, which is different than what was in the original bill, is to affirm that the professional role in licensing and so forth shall be retained where there are licensing boards. And I think that does speak to some of the concerns of the nurses and the dentists and so forth. Without arguing the point, I think the bill drafters we're conscious of retaining prerogatives in the hands of professions that we're regulating and doing through their licensing board, which have been reserved. The intent of this amendment is to allow for a central licensing file to allow some administrative efficiencies and economies, which we felt that the original bill, by creating such strong separation, precluded us from doing it if we came to legal status.
Okay. Thank you very much. Nobody in the audience has any comments on 1060. We'll close the hearing, this hearing on 1060. Graham, Dr. Crothers, Ken Underdahl, and Dr. Press to try to work out the differences between the two bills and bring us a bill that all involved can support. I'm going to close this hearing today. We have a hearing scheduled for 2:30 on 18-year-old inclusive such matters as liquor by the drink and gambling and marriage and all sorts of interesting things like that. If any monkey would like to stay and hear that, we'd be very happy to have you. Recess till 2:30. Committee on Governmental Reorganization to come to order.
Can't do that, can we?
Sure can. And he's coming back.
I can't. How are you?
You better pay strict attention because this is the bill you're going to carry.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Well, let's see what we come out with.
Okay.
You have a chance to change a copy of the...
I'm 1162.
Here, do you want a copy of the bill, Patrick? No, I think I've got the bill in my mind. I'm
Drew. You're not testifying, man.
No, we decided the committee we wanted to hear the amendments to it.
How come you can't sit up here with all us? Yes, wait on there by yourself.
Well, this is
where
I'm supposed to sit.
You're one of us.
Just have to be sure.
You're a white hat. Gosh, I don't think Kennedy's got a copy of it.
Well, criminy, I had.
Of the amendment?
1162.
1162, yeah.
Okay,
I got mine.
Here's one. Where they come from, I've never seen them before.
Okay. Okay, Kathleen.
Well, the bill was originally formulated referred to the age, specifically to the provision relating to the age of the jury instead of the rich majority, which reached 18 years of age. Now, there are a great many statutory provisions that do refer to age. So if you lower it, you buy that definition every place. But there are a great many places where the age of 21 has been used, equating that, I think, to the age of majority. But that would not automatically be changed as lowered simply because you changed the age majority. When there's a specific statutory reference to an age, you're stuck with it. So the chairman requested us to go through and examine the places where age 21 occurred, where it was akin to the age of majority rather than simply a recital for some various other reasons. So if you start off, section one of the bill relates to your ability, your competency to serve as a juror, which in Oregon is now stated at 21 years of age. We altered that to change to age of majority. Section two relates to the age of competency to bring a suit. And while the age itself refers to the age of majority, which is to bring suit without needing a guardian ad litem, the provision that allows you to delay that cause of action until such time as you, if it accrues when you're 18, until such time as you attain age, was stated in terms of 21 years. So if you're going to lower the age of majority, you should also lower the time period in which a person has to bring a suit if it accrues to him at an age earlier than that. So in this case, if the majority is 18, he has a cause of action arising when he's 18, he has under the same legal obligation to anyone else to bring a suit within the various statutes of limitations. If he's under the age of majority, he does get the extra time to do whatever he wants. Not mentally competent. The law of Oregon requires you to be 21 years of age in order to serve a summons. Section 3 tax that to the age of majority. I think section 4 relates to the service of summons outside the state.
Can we say, Kathleen, excuse me, can we say this whole bill is defining the age of majority to some extent?
Well, or indicating the places in which it's applicable to various rights and responsibilities, I think, that arise out of having attained a certain age.
And the bill sets the age of majority at 18.
At 18. Okay. These things, jurors serve the right to serve summons, the marriage license, which now for the male cannot issue between 21 years of age, forward. Adoption, which requires the written consent of an individual who is married or who is, obtained the age of majority, incident in Oregon, a woman attains her majority upon marriage. She attained her majority, but then all the things that said she had to be 21 years of age, she still couldn't do anyway, so it created a kind of interesting anomaly.
Well, upon marriage, she attains the age of majority?
She attains majority, but she still couldn't buy liquor in it. Liquor store, because that's where she's 21.
Right. So.
So she, as I say, she attained her majority for certain purposes,
but
not
for
quite a number of others.
Okay.
It created some interesting distinctions. The amendment 126 relates to the Gift to Minors Act, which allows a minor to accept a gift without being born, or would require a minor to have a guardian ad litem type thing or to receive gifts. Any person who falsely gives evidence of his age in order to obtain some benefit, and that would be age 21, change that to majority. Anyone who represents somebody under the age of majority in order to obtain any benefit.
Where are you now?
On section 10, representing himself to be under it for the purpose of securing a right or benefit or privilege. Section 11, the same kind of thing. Section 12 was admission to games of chance. You remember that if you're under 21, for instance, I think you can't go out to the racetrack. So change that. Section 13 relates to election law. Section 14 also relates, section 13 is if you can vote, section 14 I think is whether you can be a candidate for election.
Now we have a bill in here someplace lowering the age for candidates for the House of Representatives of the Senate.
Right.
that was the one that dealt with the problem of somebody who would not qualify because he couldn't have managed to register for 180 days in the party of his choice and reached 21 by the time he had to do the filing, but would have been 21 in time. This does not take care of this because it lowers the age to 18 at which you could register and everything, but doesn't build in a 180 days backwards before your 18th birthday.
Yeah, that was a bad thing, girl.
Right. I think our reaction to that one was pushing it back 3 years probably took care of the situation in which that arose. If you want to do that, though, on the bill, the other bill was in, would need to be, that age would need to be reduced to 18 and then pushed backwards to the 180 days. Service voter, same thing, has to be 18 years of age at the time of the election. Section 16 relates to the defense of minorities in order to avoid payment of certain contractual debts or higher education purposes. When you borrow money from the state in order to go to school. Section 17 is the same thing, it's a different aspect of the same kind of loans from higher ed scholarship commission. So with section 18. Section 19 is the racetrack one. The other one, I guess, would just go play cards. Section 20 relates to the racetrack. Section 21 is authorization to purchase liquor. 22 goes to the same thing.
Have one question. This bill right now takes everything that's in the ORS statutes pertaining to 21 year olds and older and now makes everything 18 and older. Is that right? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but this would change everything in the ORS so that now 21 is an immaterial age. It would be 18.
Okay. It would be 18 or age of majority, which is 18.
Yeah.
So if my reference is age of majority,
okay, so that's
your bill is initially
This takes in liquor, abortions, the whole
of abortions.
Abortions are covered in
well, so it would take in abortion.
Well, in its original version, it would have also, right? Now, the amendments are liquor, racetrack, card game, sounds like
right.
Right to sue, inability to use consent of minority or being under 21, let's phrase that way.
Would you do me a favor? If I'm going to carry this, would you prepare a general brief for me in more of a sentence form or a paragraph form or something?
Layman's form, section by section, 21.
Well, yeah. And I don't know that that's really necessary. But a general overview of exactly what this does. So that when I present it to the whole committee and then on the floor, if it gets out of the whole committee, that we're pretty well briefed on what. Can you do that for me? I'd appreciate it very much.
Okay, one more thing, Kathleen. 1275 authorized the session of the Legislative Assembly to be convened by joint resolution to consider matters specified in convening resolution or to be convened upon written request of majority of members of each house. And this bill specifies the final adjournment of constitutional or statutory session to determine the effective date of enactment of that session. I've had a question in my mind whether this is constitutional or not. It's 1275. Can we have a legislative council's opinion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I prepared that at the instruction of a member, and at the time he and I had a rather lengthy discussion on it, I have a queasy feeling about it as to whether or not, in view of the constitutional language, one would claim that that constitutional language is the exclusive method of convening the legislature. That is, that they specify in the Constitution or the provision that the governor may call special session. And whether or not you can go a point beyond that and convene a session on order of the legislature itself without a constitutional amendment, I think is open to debate. But I think the most important thing you have to have if you do that is to make sure that you specify what the adjournment date is, because the Constitution requires 90 days after signing die. And if you just read that, you never get the 90 days computed.
Why don't we ask for an AG's opinion?
Well, I've asked for an AG's opinion more than a month ago, and I can't get it out of them, and I'd like to do something with the bill, either table it or pass it out, or
I'll have turn to sit on it. But you haven't already had a hearing on it.
We haven't?
We have.
Yeah.
Well, I won't ask it of you then, because you don't think it's constitutional.
Well, I have a very queasy feeling about it, if I express it that way rather than more positively or negatively.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Captain. I appreciate it. If one could Lee have those the summary by when? If we pass this out to full committee.
Oh, tomorrow? All right.
Oh, yeah.
Why do I say things like that?
You could have said Thursday.
That House Bill 1162 be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
First, we have to accept the amendment.
As amended.
I think we better do this, Loy. First, we better approve the amendment.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'll move the adoption of the amendment.
It's been moved that the proposed amendments to House Bill 1162 be adopted. Clerk, call the roll.
Okay.
You can kind of look around.
Okay, yeah. Well, I want to write it down so I don't forget. Johnson.
Aye.
Patterson.
Aye.
And Engels.
Kennedy's excused. Okay, now we'll accept the other one.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move that House Bill 1162 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
And move that House Bill 1162 be moved to the full committee with a recommendation due pass.
Okay, Johnson.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, now we've got some other bills that we can kick out. We have four bills relative to public employee retirement and so on. All but one involve money. So it's been suggested that we kick the bills out to Ways and Means, because can do. And they're 1045. Left 1717, 1721, and 1728. I'd like a motion that those bills be moved to the Ways and Means Committee.
So moved.
It's been moved that the four bills I mentioned, you got all on?
Uh-huh.
Be sent to the Ways and Means Committee. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, now we've got... Now, Lloyd, I don't think you picked up all those bills that we sent to out on workers' compensation.
Well, I took all... there were eight, but I did wrong, but then I didn't...
I don't think you marked them off then.
No.
Okay.
I took them off the loan, but not off that.
We have hearings tomorrow on on 1661, that's the lease of certain state lands, smoking in public meetings. Stevenson said he'd come in and make a gesture on that. Obscene publication. Technical training, 1696. We've changed the hearing on Friday, March 26th, to House Bill 1046, which is the apprenticeship bill. See, we just got rid of some of these that we had scheduled for Monday for Friday. So we'll be, and you're interested in that one. 1046 on Friday.
Hope Kennedy's going to be here.
He will be, I think. Okay, now, let's see. What can we do about the Indians?
I'm trying to get Underdahl and Mann together to go over my amendments and see if we can come up with something. I'll try immediately upon adjournment to get a hold of Underdahl and Mann and see if we can meet today.
Okay, now, I didn't, on the Willamette Park, I didn't get a hold of your gal.
Mrs. Strohmeyer?
Yeah. The Nancy says those amendments are absolutely unnecessary. She's opposed to the amendments. It's her bill and she's carrying them.
Well,
I thought those amendments came from her.
Well, there's another one that Mrs. Strohmeyer wanted in.
I, no, why don't you turn that tape record? You have to have.
Try those on here.
Okay. But he'll eat me alive if we table that before I explain to him that he might be better off now. That's all I need is a newspaper publisher.
Well, have him call me.
I'll do that. I'll do that.
Or I'll call him.
He said he would be here when he got back. He's going to come down to Salem, he thought, when he gets back from that publisher's meeting or wherever he's at. In fact, they were going to hash you over, as I recall.
Well, we've got an awful lot of bills that we've had no hearing on, and you know what the speaker wanted.
Yes.
1479, 1562, 1613. We've got three bills of Kennedy's. I thought if we could ever get him sat down, maybe we could have a hearing while he's here. Taking up four of them tomorrow. Kennedy's here Wednesday, and we'll all four be here Wednesday. Okay, I guess that's about it. Let's see if any of you guys have something. Or that's the one that abolishes the Office of Secretary of State and elects the. Elects the superintendent of public instruction because there is a separate bill on electing the superintendent of public instruction.
Elect?
Abolishing the election.
I mean, abolish. No, it appoints it.
Yeah.
So moved.
It's been moved that Abstract resolution four be tabled. Any discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Bill's on workman's compensation, they just got a financial warrant. I better go see him.
Okay, well.
Senate Bill 180, and Senate Bill 187.
Yeah, I think I gave it to you.
There's your man.
Yeah.
Senate Bill 180 and 187, I'll check out.
Have you got a little time this afternoon, Ken?
Yeah.
Hey, where can I cash a $20 check in the building?
They are going to work with.
Treasury will take for. I don't think they'll get a sign up, but I've seen people in there, I want to try them. Right around the corner. You can cash a $4 or $5 check in the cafeteria.
True, let me know where they're doing it.
Okay, well, I just gave him that one.
I'm just trying to think of anybody else. Well, I think I am.
We got two of those or so. 1544 and 1555.
Are you prepared to sit down with her, man, on that Indian thing?
Yeah. I'm prepared, although we haven't really finalized it, we've got an executive order we're being issued.
State Federal Affairs Subcommittee on Governmental Reorganization meeting Tuesday, March 23rd, room 402, on House Bill 1661, 1671, 1675, and 1696.
Hey, on government reorganization coming to order, the first bill we'll hear today is 1661, Representative Mann.
We have a member of the committee. House Bill 1661 was introduced by the delegation from Umatilla County to help the construction of a facility that is known as Fort Pendleton, which has been an imaginative thing that has been proposed by the Pendleton people to provide for the authentic Western cultural flavor of the area, for the benefit of the public through educational, recreational, exhibit and structure. In order to accomplish this, the Fort Pendleton Corporate an Indian Village Incorporated, which is a nonprofit corporation made up of Pendleton businessmen for the most part, need to lease from the state a buffer area around the Eastern Oregon State Hospital. And so I think I brought this map to show you the kind of facility that they're planning and the area that they want to lease. This is Interstate 80, which goes south of Pendleton. The city of Pendleton is over here. This is Eastern Oregon State Hospital. And this is Union Pacific Railroad. Now, the Union Pacific Railroad, at times, can block both of these two entrances to the Eastern Oregon State Hospital. So, this, of course, is a controlled access highway, so it's effectively block off fire protection at those two points. Those are the only two accesses to the hospital. Now, one of the features of the Fort Pendleton plans is to put an under the railroad access right down this area. So one of the advantages to the state of executing this lease would be to provide fire protection access to Eastern Oregon State Hospital for the first time, guaranteed 24 hours a day, for the first time since the facility's been there. The proposal would be to have parking in this area. They would have a railroad station here, which would carry which visitors could get on and go throughout the area to observe it as part of the recreational facility. Here would be a frontier village with a courthouse, fire station, and a church, and here would be an old time cavalry post. There would be a park here, a a museum complex here, and a wagon yard here, and corrals and stables, and then here would be an Indian village and a zoo area. Now, you'll notice it's carefully constructed so that the quieter aspects of the thing form a complete buffer zone around the Eastern Oregon State Hospital area. And then over here would be a racetrack, which would be far removed from any of the facilities over here. This is 1 inch to 100 feet. I think that describes the features. In the Indian village, it's anticipated that Indians would exhibit the manual arts of manufacturing authentic Indian trappings, and there might possibly be a lucrative commercial development here for the Indians, where they might not only exhibit their manual arts in these manufacturing, but also they might sell these baskets, beaded baskets, and bags, and garments, and that sort of thing. I think Representative Hansel and Senator Raymond and I thought this was a bold, imaginative program to build and preserve and make live the real authentic flavor of our state. The General Services Administrator administers this area, and they were reluctant, and I think correctly, to include a lease with the Fort Pendleton Art Organization under existing statute for a nominal lease fee. And so this is the purpose of this bill. This is an aerial photograph of the area we're talking about. Now, Mr. Chairman, this bill is not a simple bill, and I think it probably would behoove me to go through it for you and point out some of its features. Number one, on page 2, line 5 and 6, any action under this bill is subject to the approval and of the governor and the administrator of the Mental Health Division. So this bill would not in itself do the job. It has to be approved as something that's commensurate with the activities that the initial purposes of the Eastern Oregon State Hospital, which is mental health. And we've carefully analyzed the plans of the Fort Pendleton people, and we find nothing of any carnival type thing or at all there. We think their plans are definitely not that kind, but still there's another check there, that is, the administrator would have a final say about it. Lines 8 and 9 indicate that this is special legislation for Fort Pendleton and Indian Village Incorporated, which is a nonprofit organization. In lines 22, 23, and 24, it authorizes the General Services Department to execute this lease for a nominal sum if the governor and the administrator approve. Lines 26 through 33 provides for sharing of monies with the state if the operations of the lessee or the subcontractors begins to show any profit after the payment of the ordinary expenditures occurred during the year, and provides for an accounting for these expenditures to the state. The reason for that is not that the nonprofit corporations be making a profit, but it's entirely possible they might run into a subcontractor, namely the Indians, might start making, or a concessionaire might start making a profit. That isn't the purpose of the bill. Over on page 3, lines 6 through 8, the lessee must pay all the taxes. Line 9 through 11.
What taxes?
Pardon me?
What taxes?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. The land was up until just within the last few months has been leased for agricultural purposes and has been paying taxes. Whether it will be removed from the tax rolls, the lease has not been renewed in anticipation of doing this type of thing. And I suppose it will stay on the tax roll. The The lessee under lines 9 through 11 must provide, that is Fort Pendleton, must provide its own separate access, which I pointed out to you there. Under lines 12 through 15, the lessee must provide his own utility services separate from Eastern Oregon State Hospital. And then the balance of the bill is provisions for termination of the lease. If the lessee fails to initiate within 2 years this activity that I've described, why the lease can be terminated. If the lessee fails to perform certain duties such as making payments, the lease can be terminated. Down to line 24, if the leased premises unreasonably interfere with the operation of Eastern Oregon State Hospital, the lease can be terminated. But the provisions of subsection 2 of section 3 have to be complied with, and that is that the department head, or that the administrator, would have to write a written request to a department head, this is the top of page 4, designated by the governor that the lease be terminated in the public interest. Lines 29 through 31, if the department receives a direction as provided in subsection 3 on page 4, which is that the division premises are again needed by the division for carrying out its lawful duties, why the lease can be terminated. Or upon written receipt by the administrator of a written complaint by the superintendent of the hospital, that the lessee's operations are unreasonably interfering with the operation of the hospital, the lease can be terminated. As I say, the general services do not feel that they could execute this kind of lease without special legislation. This is the bill that will enable them to execute the lease. I think it has all kinds of safeguards written in for the integrity of the Eastern Oregon State Hospital as a mental institution. And I would make one more point, and that is that I'm satisfied that the man let his lease lapse on his agricultural lease because he wasn't a profitable thing for him to do.
Another question, Mr. Mann?
This wouldn't be a competitive lease, somebody else couldn't bid on it.
No.
The Boeing Corporation doesn't have any interest in this.
They haven't evinced any interest thus far. Of course, when they find out the potentials, like, we better hurry.
How will the fee be established?
Well, I suppose it'd be $1 a year. That's what's anticipated in the bill, nominal sum. Plus any share in any concessionaire profit that have to turn up.
Who pays for this underpass?
Fort Pendleton.
Where did they get their money? Subscription? Well,
yes, they've had this going for about 3 or 4 years up there, and they have some money. I don't know that I have anything about their financial situation, but I'm assured that they're not going to ask for any public monies to construct this facility.
You talk about it being a non-profit corporation, and I'm sure most of these things turn out that way, whether they did or not. But then you talk about paying dividends to the state of it.
They began speaking of the possibility of making a Western kind of store there that was run by the Indians, and they talked about the possibility of certain concessions.
Is there any conflict of interest to put a commercial venture on state-owned ground?
Well, they never contemplated it be a commercial venture. This was just really, I don't care if that section's in there, but it's in there in case one of the lessees does have to.
I'm only asking for information.
I don't call it a commercial venture because but it is strictly nonprofit.
It's more of a community endeavor.
Oh, yes.
Well, but the Indians will be making something off of it, I hope.
I would hope so, too. The Indians should surely be in no competition with any existing enterprise.
How many areas are you talking about?
How many?
Mm-hmm. The letter there states 7. 70? My letter behind it.
It says 70?
Approximately 70 acres.
You said how many Indians do we talk
No, about? Acres, I'm sorry.
Oh, acres?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you said Indians.
No. How many Indians are we talking about here?
That letter is accurate. And it is totally landlocked except for whatever access the organization would build in there under the railroad track.
Is there any problem of paying county property taxes on state-owned property?
No, I don't. No, they collect taxes right now and have for a long time.
Irv, I'm not opposed to your bill. Maybe you can clarify something here. Says the leasee pay or cause to be paid each year the lawful taxes levied with respect to the value of the lease premises and the value of the lease.
Yes, this is the answer. The lease is what is taxed, and if it has any value, it's taxed on that value as a piece of personal property.
Because on 179055 it says the division may make necessary repairs and improvements on the property described in this subsection, which this would be the Department of General Services. The proceeds derived from the rental or lease of the property shall be used to pay taxes, repairs, and improvements. So who is the Department of General Services going to pay the taxes?
No, the Fort Pendleton Incorporated pays the taxes under this bill.
Are there any more questions of Mr. Mann?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The same bill, Bray.
Don Bray, Assistant Administrator, Mental Health Division. With Dr. Silt and looked at the property and asked him for his comment, and he has submitted those to us in the letter which I've attached to this testimony. Very simply, it doesn't appear that this proposal would in any way interfere with our programs in Eastern Oregon. The land amounts to 42 acres of rocky ground. I think the letter covered the points that 1 through 4 fairly clearly. You're probably able to read through it more rapidly than I can read it out loud to you.
You say 42 acres and Representative Mann says 70. Is there a meeting of the minds on how much they are going to get?
Did Eric go? This 42 acres was apparently Dr. Silt's understanding of the amount. I think there's enough buffer zone there that this is wouldn't be a critical issue. I think the underpass being available to the hospital is an important point, and this is something that we've been concerned about for fire safety at the hospital. You may be aware was in our budget request to Ways and Means this session.
How many patients do you have up there, Dr. Bray?
There are around in the 400s on the mentally ill side. It's a divided hospital, mental illness and mental retardation. And it's in the 800s totally, but evenly divided between the mentally retarded and the mentally ill. The hospital has been diminishing in size. And it's predicted to continue to do so at a little slower rate than Oregon State Hospital.
Okay. Are there any other questions about
thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now turn our attention to, are most of you people here on what? Where's the other stuff?
They are, they're
just listening.
Oh. Okay, we'll turn our attention then to House Bill 1696.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Nordyke, and I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the Employment Division. House Bill 1696 is intended to correct the problem that the agency has experienced in priorities in referring persons for vocational or technical training under the provisions of the Manpower Development and Training Act. The Oregon law, when it was originally drawn, set certain priorities which are, we've discovered, inconsistent with the provisions of the federal law, and so we propose to amend in section 1, subsection 2, so that the law would read, priorities and referral for which vocational or technical training shall be consistent with the Manpower Development and Training Act of 1962, U.S. Public Law 87-415 as amended, and the rules of the United States Secretary of Labor. Reason being that the United States Secretary of Labor frequently changes by rule within the limits of the federal law these priorities. And so we want to be in a position to take advantage of the federal law, and at the present time we're having problems, particularly with respect to veterans who are quite often eligible for some assistance, but under our law, if they're entitled to any assistance, why, we can't refer them for training, and they badly need it. So that is the reason. Now, I've submitted an explanation of the federal requirements on priority, and you will notice, in addition to those on the first page, that preference must be given to veterans from 50. The 65% of the referrals must also be from a disadvantaged, depending on the particular program that they're asking for. If you have any other questions concerning how this thing operates, we have Mr. Sisma here from the Employment Division who does head this program out. It's quite a simple bill. We have only that one amendment in there to provide that the priorities be consistent with the Manpower Development Training Act.
What does non-compliance do? What services or facilities is this limited to?
Well, of course, we're just unable to take advantage of federal funds to pay for the cost of this training. If we have provisions in the state law which give a different set of priorities to those individuals who are to be trained than what the United States Secretary of Labor has determined should be the priority. In other words, they're saying that if you're going to use federal funds, you're going to follow our priorities.
Yes, they've been saying that loud and clear over a number of
years. Yeah, they certainly have. But that's the prime reason for the bill. And of course, we have the emergency clause on there because we do have some pressing problems right now that we would like to be able to resolve and do it as quickly as we can to get on with the program.
Is there any more questions of Mr. Nordyke? I think we understand it. Thank you very much, Mr. Nordyke. There's nobody here to testify. We'll close the hearing on 1696. Is there anybody here to testify on 1675, the obscene publications bill? Is there anyone here to... Anyone here to testify on 1671, smoking in public meetings? We will have Mr. Stevenson.
Chairman?
Yes.
Will I be ruled out of order if I start making some motions?
Nope.
I'll move table 1675. Being a former publisher or a former publisher, I don't think you want all that power.
Thank you. A move has been made to table House Bill 1675. The sponsor of the bill, I think, would not be unhappy with this action. You've heard the motion. Clerk, call the roll.
Johnson?
No.
Patterson?
No.
Kennedy?
Aye.
English?
Aye. Motion on, as long as he's sitting here looking down our throats, and we may have something of interest to him, I'll accept the motion on 1661.
Mr. Chairman, full committee will do pass recommendation.
It's been moved that House Bill 1661 be moved to full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Question? Clerk, call the roll.
Johnson?
Aye.
Patterson?
Oh, yeah.
Kennedy?
Aye.
Engel?
Aye. Mr. Mann, will you carry this bill on the floor?
Be delighted, thank you.
Okay. I move that House Bill 1696 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
We move that House Bill 1696 be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Johnson?
Aye.
Patterson?
Sorry.
Kennedy?
Aye.
Engel?
Aye. Mr. Kennedy?
I move that House Bill 1671 be re-referred to the Committee on Rules.
Is that the one I think it is? I can't adjourn the meeting because I've got another bill to kill.
I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay, thank you. I talked to Representative Densmore, who has something here on Memorial to Congress, I guess it is, on the Constitution that was passed today already. There's nobody here to testify on it.
You want to testify?
Did you want to testify on it?
No, I just wanted to hear somebody else.
Well, the sponsor of the bill, Representative Elliott, spoke to me earlier about the bill, and he had put it in at the request of some other people, he said, and did not intend to testify on it himself, but if they came, it would be fine.
There's so many angles to it.
Well, I think the committee felt it was too difficult, really, to put into law.
Well, my husband was an attorney in New York City for many years, and he had some of these, and he proved the law in New York State was unconstitutional, but they had already passed. So I know, well, that's why we were particularly interested in it.
Well,
can't do anything about it unless you have somebody
here. No. We did something about it. We tabled it.
No, we didn't.
No,
we didn't. I thought you tabled it.
I was 2-2.
Okay.
was what?
It was 2-2.
Oh, 2-2.
Oh, well, if you can't do anything,
well,
then
somebody
here's
job.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, I'm sure. Did anybody find that house from Memorial?
Is it yours?
No, it's what's
it deal with?
It deals with the constitutional amendment, a memorial to Congress on the constitutional amendment to an 18-year-old voting.
It's JN-15.
I think that's what it is.
I assume that Mr. Dinsmore doesn't think we need to pass this since the Congress is going to act.
That's correct. They've already acted. They acted.
I'd move the House Joint Memorial number 15 be tabled.
Move the House Joint Memorial 15 be tabled.
Excuse me.
I can't find that in my book.
It's right there.
I can't find it in my
book.
The House did pass it, I believe.
Yes.
I haven't got it either.
Well, we don't need to look at it because I know you know what it is.
No, I don't.
Oh.
That's fine. I just want to know what.
Why did you move it?
Yes.
Call a roll.
No discussion. Clerk, call a roll.
Okay, Johnson.
Aye.
Patterson.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Engel.
Aye. Do you want to remake your motion?
Wait a minute.
On 16, I thought Stevenson would be here.
1675.
And it's been moved that House Bill 1675 be tabled. Okay. Clerk, call a roll.
I'd like to see if I was
there. It's the one we just did 2-2. Well,
sponsor wants a table.
Stick to your guns, that's all right. I'll tell you why later.
Clerk, call a roll.
John.
Aye.
Patterson.
No.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Aye. Oh, listen, can we take up a couple of yours?
One?
Yeah.
Sure.
Did you say which?
I have 12.
I don't have any HJMs in here.
Yeah, take the stand. We'll open hearings on House Joint Resolution Memorial 12. Representative Kennedy.
There's a whole section that says HJM.
All right, I was looking at my other section, HJM.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Kennedy. I'm a representative from Lane County, testifying on behalf of House Joint Memorial Number 12, which is a memorial to Congress of the United States, urging them to abolish the Electoral College and provide for the direct election of the President of the United States. The memorial, in effect, asks the Congress to adopt what is commonly referred to as the Birch-Bayh Amendment, which would, first of all, as I mentioned before, abolish the Electoral College, would secondly create a system for the direct election of the President of the United States by all of the qualified voters of the nation. And this amendment, which is before the Congress, has been for several years, I think, provides a check which meets, I think, at least a great deal of the opposition in the past against abolishing the Electoral College. The objections that have been raised for many, many years concerning abolishing the Electoral College in favor of the direct election of the president are related around the fact that in countries that do have a system of direct elections, you also find often that you have a multiplication of political parties. And many people believe that the real strength of our system is the fact that we have generally had only two parties and not five parties or 10 parties or 15 parties, political parties, that is, that break into splinter groups, such as I think you'll find in France as an example. The memorial, and as well as the bi-bill, requires that a successful candidate must receive no less than 40% of all the votes cast for president to be elected. And in the event that no candidate receives 40% of the votes cast for president, then the two candidates receiving the highest number of votes cast would be candidates in the second election, and the candidate receiving the highest number of votes in the second election would be the one that would be the president elect. Now, I think this meets one of the big objections to abolishing the Electoral College that has historically been a major issue. I recognize that I think that a case can be made that in abolishing the Electoral College that perhaps, depending on whose viewpoint you look at, that small states will be hurt or large states will be hurt. You can make, a valid argument either way. But I think it's more important to recognize that in 1968 we came awfully close to what I would consider a constitutional crisis. There have been several states that have gone slightly different in the way they voted, why there would have been no individual elected in the issue of electing the president would have been thrown into the House of Representatives. And this, I think, could and would create a constitutional crisis in the United States. And I think that this thing could happen, perhaps even more likely to happen in 1972. It's apparent, if you read the papers, that George Wallace once again will be a presidential candidate. It's possible that Senator McCarthy will be an independent candidate, third-party candidate. And I think it's possible that we could face this constitutional crisis in 1972, and that's so I would hope that we pass this memorial and urge the Congress to act affirmatively on the Bay Amendment. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Johnson?
Yeah.
Go ahead,
Ed. It's always been a concern of mine when we talk about popular elections, the lack of power that a single voter would have, being the mass of how many voters do we have in the United States, but you're a very small voice. I'm also concerned about the constitutional problem we might have if someone didn't receive the mandatory number of votes. And it seems to me that there is an alternative to the popular election, and an alternative would seem that it possibly would be the individual voters, a segment of individual voters, electing an elector. And I think there should be an alternative proposal, and I'd like for you to comment if there is. You evidently have studied it substantially, and if there is an alternative to the popular election.
Well, there's a whole host of alternatives that have been proposed over the years. There was the Lodge Gossett plan, which was considered rather seriously in the late 40s and early 50s, which would have provided for amended the Constitution to provide for a proportional vote, electoral vote, whereby if one candidate received 55% of the popular vote in Oregon and the other candidate received 45% of the electoral vote of Oregon, would be apportioned equally 55-45, or as close as possible. There's a more recent proposal that would provide for some kind of a congressional district apportionment of electoral votes. There are, no question, a number of alternatives that would at least partially solve the problem. My judgment, this is that the direct election is the most reasonable one, and I think it's the one that, if you can believe the public opinion polls, it's the one that the people want. It's the one they would prefer.
I think such small states as Oregon would be severely handicapped in the lack of campaigning, the lack of effort made for going in votes because they're small population.
I don't think so at all. I think if you looked at this issue maybe 10 or 20 years ago, that you might be able to make a case for that. But I don't think you can now. The one thing, the only reason a candidate, well, we have a primary, so candidates come to Oregon because of the primary. And as long as we have a primary, we'll get major attention from candidates. And if you look at the behavior of political candidates after the primary, you don't see too many of them under the present system in Oregon. I think another reason is if you've ever been involved in a presidential political campaign, you realize that the real reason they come to Oregon or go anyplace else really is not to just talk to people in Oregon, although they consider this to be important, but they're really talking to the national audience. And if you've ever read an advance manual or a rally man's manual or a campaign manual for a presidential election, the first paragraph in each one of these manuals will talk about the fact that if a presidential candidate spoke for 365 days to 5,000 people six times a day, they would have talked personally through a campaign perhaps 3 to 5% of the eligible voters in the United States. And the second paragraph goes on to say, so therefore, what we're trying to do when we talk to groups is to make sure that good film and good press is made available to the media following the candidate, so that when the tube goes on at 6 o'clock, Huntley or Brinkley or Cronkite's on, that film will show the candidate in a favorable way. So I think with television that you're not going to, where people, they campaign where they can get good coverage. And a state like Oregon lends itself as well as any other state to this purpose. You'll find candidates, for example, always going to Alaska, and there's 105,000 registered voters in the state of Alaska. But the film they pick up and the coverage they get is very, very
question I would have would be just the opposite. Do you think that under this system that we would be encouraging higher campaign expenditures, needless to say, on a national level? I was looking at it opposite of what Ed was, that maybe the states like Oregon would become all the more important because it could be that close in a popular vote.
Well, I think that you can argue the point, I think, with validity either way. I mean, you can make a case either way. You can presently, what is it, 10 states? You can carry 15 states and win the election. I think you can make a case, well, if you abolish the Electoral College, that a vote in Oregon is as important as a vote in New York. Except I don't really think it's just important, but I think you'll still find the candidates spending an awful lot of time in New York simply because there's more people that live in New York. So you can make a case either way.
There's a bill before this legislative body which would move the primaries to September. If that were to pass, would it make any difference insofar as the appearance of the presidential candidates in the state of Oregon?
I think it would diminish. Well, we would, if we moved the primary to September, we obviously wouldn't have a presidential preference primary in September because both of the candidates would have already been chosen. So I personally would not favor abolishing the presidential primary in Oregon. If we move the date to August or September for our regular elections, I would still favor maintaining the presidential primary in May.
As I recall, in the last session, you had a similar memorial to Congress. Is this the same?
Yes, and it passed the last session with your no vote.
Yes, with my no vote. Of course, I'll argue with you on the congressional districts and the two senators as a benefit to Oregon. Rich, is there any problem of finding out who actually has been elected after the date for inauguration under the popular vote? If there's a contested election in Illinois and Texas, etc., is it possible that we might not know who's elected until?
Yes, it's possible. But it's possible under the present system, too, though. Because if there's a contested election in, in Illinois or in Texas, those votes would be contested under either system. If Illinois or Texas made a difference in the electoral college.
Is there any provision of throwing the election into the House of Representatives under the by amendment?
No.
That's out then.
It is out. No, there would, under the by amendment, you would not throw any.
There
would be any House Representative would be thrown out.
And this does away with the Tilden election, where the man receiving the fewer number of votes is elected president.
That's correct.
Are there any questions, any more questions of Mr. Kennedy on this amendment? Anybody in the audience have any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Kennedy. That closes the hearing on House Joint Memorial 12. I'll accept the motion. I think you're going to lose passage, so I have to vote for it.
I'll move the House Joint Memorial 12 to send the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Is it a parody when you move this out of committee? I'd like to think about that.
You want to think about that?
I'll withdraw my motion.
Okay, well,
I'm not saying I'm opposed to it. I just like to think about it a little bit.
Okay, that's fine. That's your right. We want you to think. Are you prepared to discuss Martin Luther King?
No, not today.
Okay, you've got another one in here. Are you prepared to discuss that? Lawyer, I had a digest of the darn things.
Yeah, I can.
What time was Representative Stevenson supposed to be here?
Well, I told him he didn't want to make a public display, and I told him to come after it. Well, but I didn't know we were going to get through so quick on the other four. He's going to come at three. We can recess and come back. 17. You want to take that one?
I have to go down to my office and get some material.
Well, maybe tomorrow afternoon we will hear House Bill 1057. Your government reorganization will come to order. The bill we'll discuss is 1671.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for setting this particular time for me to discuss with you House Bill 1671. There's been quite a bit of discussion already about the merits and demerits of smoking in enclosed places, such as committee rooms, the House chamber, etc., so I'm not going to belabor the issues. I think we'll discuss them rather extensively. Suffice to say, I think there's very sufficient reason on grounds of respect for the rights of non-smokers as well as smokers, on the grounds of respect for the health and comfort of all individuals, and taking into consideration environmental factors and precedent to require that there be no smoking in public meetings. This bill, of course, would apply to all types of public meetings, and although I recognize that the sentiment is not
overwhelming in support of this type of measure. I think eventually we're going to reach this point. I had hoped that it might be this session, but I do believe that it's going to happen sometime in the future. I would urge you to support and pass to the floor of the House, House Bill 1671.
Bill, we have another bill, 1044, which has in it the problem of defining what a public employer is. I just wonder if there's any, is there a definition of a public body other than what you have here?
I don't know if there is or not, frankly. Ordinarily, the people in legislative council, if there was, they would go to that definition and try to work with it, I think. I don't know if they took that from a present statute or if they just created this definition.
If we were having a meeting like this one here and somebody lit up a cigarette in the back row, I see it's a misdemeanor, what do we do? Does somebody have to prosecute them or call the security police and arrest them? And then,
well, I suppose if you wanted to go to that length, I imagine if the person wasn't willing to comply with the law and the regulations, I wouldn't visualize from a practical standpoint that would happen. The person would be advised of the rules and could take a choice of complying with the rule or leaving.
Or we just put up no smoking signs around, but at the city halls and county courthouses and so forth.
I think it's a serious problem. This people that are allergic to smoking, I was surprised, frankly, I didn't realize the extent to which non-smokers and people who have health problems have been kind of putting up with this thing over the years. I don't know why, but they just felt that, you know, no sense in bucking the tide. And I've gotten quite a significant response, I think, from individuals who have problems. It's kind of like an iceberg.
I only have one question, and we laughed at it when Representative Henderson presented on the floor to explain his vote, but there are some very, very obnoxious persons and so forth that have the same effect on people. I have signed off and had it since the day I was born. And certain kinds of perfumes will plug me up and bother me and make my eyes water quicker than cigarette smoke will. And I think that's just as offensive as some deodorants and some body odors and some hairsprays as cigarette smoking is.
All those items are sold by pharmacists too, aren't they?
Yeah, I think maybe that's the place to start.
Right, well, I was going to make that very point. I think you're correct. Being a married man, I don't have the opportunity to be exposed to as many varieties as you do, Representative Johnson.
I knew you were going to come out with something like that.
I can't appreciate your problem, but you may have a point in the... certainly consider supporting a bill if you'd like to introduce one, if you'd be willing to support mine.
Fair enough.
Bill, I didn't support your other bill, but for a different reason. I feel very strongly that the legislature really should not be providing legislation governing all aspects of all other public meetings. And I think each public body has within its power and jurisdiction the ability to make rules regulating the conduct of their meetings, and certainly I would think whether they're smoking or not smoking. And this is one of the arguments that I have against this present bill. And again, it's a total different aspect than I looked at it the last time because of the rule change with the House of Representatives. But that's my sentiment. I thought if you wanted to react to that, I would let you know this.
Yeah, obviously I don't agree with you. I recognize that feel justified in that argument, although we as legislators legislate on a great many subjects and areas that might better be left to local jurisdictions. And this, I think reasonable men can differ as to whether it should be done here at this level or at a local jurisdiction. So, I recognize your argument, I just don't have to agree with it.
Okay, Bill, we appreciate your coming up, and
thanks very much.
I would suggest if you put in a bill relative to the House floor that if you include the bar only within the bar, it would probably pass.
Well, be careful now. I would buy that with, you know, don't wrap that gavel yet. You brought it up. I'll make one other statement. I would agree with that too, and I'd buy it, and I'm an avid smoker, as long as we take two other steps, as long as we make everybody stay in their chairs during a session, and as long as we eliminate newspapers from the floor, because it's more of an image standpoint on the floor of the House than it is anything else.
What about secretaries?
Well,
they enhance the image.
It's all I'm saying is I think the valid point you have with smoking on the floor is some of the impression that we leave with the people that are sitting in the gallery. And that room is big enough and well ventilated enough. I've never felt that cigarette smoke was a problem in there, but I would agree with you on the image part of it. But I also think if we're going that far, that we all ought to be required to stay at our desks, and we ought to eliminate newspapers from the floor of the House, because I think that is bad.
I do too. I agree with both of them.
So if you know,
I go one step farther.
Image factors, you know, is an argument, but that's the last of my arguments. Place the bottom on the list. And the House chamber can be a problem if you're in a direct line.
You're
right
that now. I've got another meeting.
State and Federal Affairs Subcommittee on Governmental Reorganization meeting Wednesday, March 24th, room 106B, until 10:57.
The House Subcommittee on Government Reorganization, please come to order.
We are opening our second hearing on House Bill, on the popular House Bill 1057. Mr. Schroeder, State Forestry Department. Are you familiar with the 1969 version of this bill which passed the House? Generally, yes.
Do you have an opinion one way or the other about the merits of the two bills?
Yes, you had asked me to respond to this bill. My concern differs between the two bills that I think are two points that were concerning to me is number one, the bill was amended in 1969, maintained policy-making authority for the board. And this I support very much as I interpret this bill and question whether they are any longer a policy-making board. I feel that the Board of Forestry is comp- complemented by 11 very active and competent individuals that contribute a great deal to the decision-making processes in our department. And I think the state of Oregon would probably be losing a very valuable asset if they were to make these men less responsible, and as a consequence, we wouldn't get the caliber type of man functioning in the role that they are providing. The other point, of course, that we were concerned with on the bill is, as we understand it, this is the selection, and possibly this has been resolved here on the selection of the department head, because this is one of my own personal reactions to the thing. It doesn't involve the department head politically, and characteristically, our department has not been involved in politics and political head. This lends itself to figuring a professional service like forestry, and it should be maintained in a professional manner. These are the two.
Would your board, or would you personally support the 1959 bill, 69 bill?
Would I support the 1969 bill? I think that I appeared in testimony of being before the 69 subcommittee and stating that I can see merits in the 69 legislation in the effort to provide opportunity for various departments working together that might provide certain benefits to the state. On the other hand, I don't see any advantages of bringing these departments ahead under a political type of appointment, which the setting of priorities between various administrative agencies on the type of service which should be concentrated on by departments necessarily the best way to get reaction on the various programs. I say this particularly, I think that take forestry, which is probably a relatively non-glamorous type of subject, which is still would probably be the key of the group in the area of economics. And to put this under the enticing representation that can come into the general public in such areas of fishing game, and then set priorities on that on the program area, it seems to me like forestry could, might be able to better represent itself as an independent.
Somewhat facetiously, is it not you who decides whether the woods are open or closed in hunting? Don't you approach?
We have that authority on certain classes of land.
I just wondered if you're ever emotionally involved in decisions. I mean, decisions that involve emotional people. Are there any other questions of Mitch Stroyer? Thank you very much, sir. We appreciate your reluctant testimony. Hey, you don't want your motion. You might want to.
Can I just do something to film?
Mr. Shunning, Oregon Fish Commission.
Director of the Fish Commission, I'm speaking in that capacity. House Bill 1057 creates a Department of Natural Resources with a number of administrative divisions, including the Fisheries Division. The Fish Commission has serious reservations about at least two of the significant provisions in the bill as presently written. The first is that the bill provides for the Director of Natural Resources to appoint the Administrator of the Fisheries Division from a panel of three qualified persons nominated by the Fish Commission. At the present time, the Administrator of the Fish Commission is appointed by the Commissioners for a four-year term. Under the bill, the Division Head presumably would serve at the pleasure of the Natural Resources Director. The Commissioners believe the present system in which they select the State Fisheries Director for a four-year term has given stability, stature, and continuity to this organization. That would be in jeopardy. The administration of the state's food fish resources has profited from this procedure, and it is far preferable to the system used in some other states, where the director of the fish and or wildlife agency is selected by the governor or his representative, and policies, and science become politically rather than resource-oriented. The second is a potential policy conflict. As we interpret the bill as written, the commissioners, in theory at least, would still have policy-making authority and would work directly with the division head in this respect. However, the Department of Natural Resources director would appoint the division head, set his salary, and apparently have considerable input into his activities. The division head would have two immediate bosses, the commissioner on one hand and the department head on the other. At times, it is conceivable this would result in extremely awkward and undesirable circumstances in attempting to administer the state's fishery resources. It could put the division administrator in an impossible situation on controversial matters. It appears that the bill would, in effect, shift some of the policy-making authority of the commissioners to the director of the Department of Natural Resources. General supervision of the department and coordination of plans and policies of the administrative divisions by the department head, as provided in the bill, could allow this. Further, it could be a logical step to phasing out the commission form of government. We believe the state benefits immeasurably from the competent, experienced guidance provided by such non-salary commissioners. The people of Oregon would suffer a significant and measurable loss by abolishing such a system, or even by reducing its effectiveness by lessening of commissioner authority. It is our impression that one of the primary reasons for House Bill 1057 is to expedite the planning and coordination of policies to develop, use, and conserve the natural resources of the state in a manner which will provide optimum benefit to present and future generations. We endorse this concept and agree with the need. However, we do not think that House Bill 1057 is necessary to accomplish that objective. There is much coordinated planning among the natural resource agencies now. In order to make changes as significant as provided for in the bill, there should be some meaningful, tangible gains that are not evident to us today. There are also some technical problems associated with present wording, such as funding for the administration of the department and the beginning and ending dates of the fish commissioner terms. In summary, we strongly favor the present commission system in administering the food fish fishery laws of the state. It has been a very satisfactory, successful, and workable administrative organization. It is responsive to the needs of the resource and the best interests of the people of Oregon. We see no convincing reasons for changing this organizational structure along the lines proposed in the bill. Hence, we do not support House Bill 1057.
Yes, that's clear enough. No questions.
No, the only question I would have is if how the Fish Commission stood on House Bill 1597 from last session.
It's my recollection we took no position.
Would you wish to say you don't want to take any position on that now?
I'm not prepared to make a position statement today. We would not be hesitant to do so, but I'd have to consult with policymakers.
Okay. I have no questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kennedy.
I would move that page 2 through 23 be deleted from House Bill 1057. And that House Bill 1597, Johnson, is that correct? The number of the bill.
1596.
And that engrossed House Bill 1597 in the 1969 session be substituted.
Mr. Kennedy, Representative Kennedy has moved that House Bill 1057 be
engrossed with House 1969 to House Bill 1097. Anyway, you know what he's talking about.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Engel.
Aye.
Motion's carried.
Anybody else want to say anything at this time?
Anybody like to testify in 1597?
Anybody want to testify on 2 years ago, Bill?
Meeting's adjourned.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
There'd be an opportunity then to comment on, you know, I did girls.
We'll go through the same procedures all over again, Ward.
I want to pass out the floor, Senate joint resolution, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What? And we tabled Mount Shawn Memorial 12.
Yes, we do.
What?
Not you. No, that's not 12.
The one on 15.
15, yeah.
Oh, no, we didn't table that. No, we can pass this one. Would you like to make a motion, or did we pass it?
What are we doing?
He wanted to think about it.
Yeah, and I was trying to Memorial 12. He wanted to think about it.
Well, wait a minute. Which one
that's
is
the Electoral College one.
Go ahead if you want to.
Okay. It's been moved that House Joint Memorial 12 be sent to the full committee with a new pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call or roll.
Johnson.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Aye. I'm not sure I'll vote for it.
I'm not sure I will either, but.
House Joint Resolution 4 was tabled. 9 was tabled. 15 we passed. Now we want to do the Senate Joint Resolution. Whatever the hell it is.
Senate Joint Resolution number 7.
Yeah.
As amended. You want this album?
Yes.
I'd move that Senate Joint Resolution number 7 be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
I move the Senate Joint Resolution be sent to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Okay, now what part is this going to play with our...
I'll give you my position, or maybe Bob wants to give it. My position has no... The issues are totally separate. Notwithstanding that 5 states have already ratified yesterday, I think the state of Washington.
I don't think that was his question. His question was, what does this have to do with the bill we passed relative to...
Age of majority.
That's your question. That's already on its way.
Well, I realize, but... I don't know what I'm trying to say. There's a hang-up in here, though.
This is all right, please.
Well, in other words, you want to tie them together, will
you? Well, that's what we did with the other one, though. We gave them the right to vote.
No, we didn't. We didn't give them the right to do anything under the other one, except that if this passes, the voters of the people, then those others become operative.
This doesn't pass.
Okay. Question's been called for.
Okay. Johnson?
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Engel. Aye. We've got a problem, and I've got to worry about it a little bit. Representative Kennedy would like to amend House Bill or Joint Resolution 7, which we have tabled.
House Joint Resolution 9.
9. To open up hearings. On the legislature approving the constitutional amendment as provided by the federal Congress and the 18-year-old vote.
I think it was, if I may speak to the, I've got the language down, it's all prepared and ready to go. There's 2 ways this could be done. One way would be to go through the Rules Committee and get a new resolution. The easiest way, and I've already asked Representative Robertson, chief sponsor, whether it's all right, but just delete all the language in this resolution. It's got the legislative council says the title's fine. Delete everything and put it in there. But I think that And I'm not, I don't, I think it's a, this legislature has an obligation to consider ratifying or not to ratify that constitutional amendment. I think that's, I think we'd be remiss if we did not consider that issue, since it's legitimately before us.
Why don't you bring it to the next meeting?
Okay, I'll have it here once.
Now, what did we just do with?
Okay, that's what I was.
We got three bills in here, we're all trying to get passed out on 18-year-old votes.
This is a separate issue. This Congress yesterday approved a proposed constitutional amendment which lowered the voting age to 18, which must be ratified by 3/4 of the states. 3/4 of the states ratified that, and you have 18-year-old vote for all elections. Okay. So that's one issue. The other issue, of course, is what we just acted upon, and that is to submit the thing to the vote of the people of the state of Oregon to amend our own constitution to lower the voting age to 18. Now, the reason that there's really separate issues, there's no way we know that 3/4 of the states are going to ratify. So they're separate issues. There's no way we know whether we're going to ratify. So I think it would be remiss if the legislature didn't at least consider the issue since it's before us. That's my position. I'm not asking anybody to.
Well, in other words, if 3/4 of the states ratify what Congress did, then.
That's it. Then there's 18.
Doesn't make any difference about our Constitution or not.
Right. But if they don't ratify.
Don't ratify, then this
stands alone.
Stands alone.
The one question I'd like to introduce into your thinking, and that is whether you want to do it by legislative action directly or by referral on the ratification. I don't know the legality. Well, I urge that you wait until we've asked the Attorney General to advise us if the legislature can, in its discretion, refer ratification to the people. You should wait until you know what the answer to that question is before you move.
I asked that question to the Attorney General last night informally, so. And that's why I'm in no hurry to have a hearing on this, personally, but I think it ought to be before us.
What did he say?
What? He had too many martinis.
Okay. Is there anything else we can't accomplish with the three of us? Do we have any bills waiting to be moved out besides these?
I don't think so. We've moved them all out.
I don't think of any either. You